This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we find out more about a major gambling package approved in the state legislature. Those who want to wager will soon have more opportunities to do so. As the school year wraps up, we visit one Northern Illinois high school where students won't be returning next year. It's being deactivated. We'll explain. Flying insects are prevalent this spring. What's behind the swarms we're seeing? Also, an iconic restaurant brand that got its start here in Illinois facing some tough times.
I mean, they're playing smack dab in a very competitive set from big national players, right? That have huge reach and big marketing dollars, and all the way down to small local or regional chains or even independent burger places.
Problems at Steak and Shake. That and more on today's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll recap the busy end of the spring legislative session, including what happened at the State House and how it will impact you. Also, flying insects. If you spent much time outside, you've probably been dealing with the nuisance of mosquitoes and gnats. They've been especially bad this spring. We'll find out why. We'll talk to an entomologist. That and more this hour on Statewide. Chain restaurants love moving into downstate Illinois. Steak and Shake was that rare unicorn, the chain restaurant that downstate sent out to the world. But 85 years after its founding in Normal, Steak and Shake, an iconic brand, is in trouble. Brian Denham has more on that.
Our story begins with Greg Snodgrass, who started at Steak and Shake as a busboy in 1979 in Bloomington Normal. His career grew as the company did, and other local staff would travel the country to help open new locations and train staff on the Steak and Shake culture, quality service, and cleanliness.
We have little meetings 15 minutes before our shift started, and we'd have uniform inspections and the whole nine yards. It was really something that we all took pride in.
It was fun. But by 2008, it wasn't fun anymore. Snodgrass was a district manager then, overseeing nine locations between Bloomington and Paducah, Kentucky. Snodgrass says the new owner, Big Laurie Holdings, was cutting wages and benefits, part of a recession-era discounting survival plan. So Snodgrass left. Today, those changes have brought Steak and Shake to the brink. Sales have sunk, dozens of locations have closed, employee lawsuits have piled up, and some are speculating that a major contraction, or worse, is near.
It's heartbreaking, quite honestly. I dedicated over 30 years of my career to help build that company, to help build relationships. And when you walk into the restaurants and the service isn't good and the cleanliness isn't there, the quality of the food is still there, but if you don't have the other two things, it really isn't Steak and Shake anymore to me.
Steak and Shake is one of Bloomington Normal's most famous exports, right up there with State Farm and Beer Nuts. Gus and Edith Belt opened the first location at Main Street and Virginia Avenue in Normal in 1934. Their family sold the company in 1969, and it's changed hands many times since then. Today, Steak and Shake has 580 locations and is based in Indianapolis and owned by Texas-based Big Laurie Holdings. Bill Kemp with the McLean County Museum of History says another locally grown company that followed a similar path was Eureka Williams, which became Electrolux and then moved away.
Bloomington Normal, given kind of its vibrancy throughout its history, has produced corporations or brand names that are known throughout the country, sometimes in some cases the world, and some of those still have local ties and some do not.
There are a few remnants of the Steak and Shake legacy that have survived here. The chain still has four restaurants in town. The original one on Main Street, though, is now a Monocle's. Another old location is now Keller's Iron Skillet. Kemp says Gus and Edith Belt built Steak and Shake's brand on the steak burger.
Gus Belt was known to make quite a show of that. He would actually wheel in a barrel in some of the early stores full of sirloins or T-bones, and then that would be ground right on site so customers could see what was going into their steak burgers.
Cleanliness was also a selling point. Their slogan was, "In sight, it must be right."
The idea was if you could see the food being made, so the grill cooks were out there in the open through glass windows, and originally the meat was ground on site. That was an indication that things were on the up and up there.
But that was a long time ago. Today, the company is owned by Sardar Big Laurie, a young investor who emigrated to the U.S. from Iran. He took over Steak and Shake in 2008 amid the Great Recession. He discounted relentlessly, famously offering meals under $4, and it worked. Sales soared.
For 7 years, he he seemingly could do no wrong.
That's Greg Andrews, who's covered the company extensively as editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal.
That worked and worked and worked, and then about 2016 it stopped working, and the company has continued to really slide since then.
Critics say the customer experience slipped, and so did the service. All that discounting comes at a cost. Steak and Shake also faced a new challenge from growing fast casual chains like Chipotle, Panera, and Jason's Deli. Younger consumers were willing to pay more, and the race to the bottom for value was ending. That's according to Danny Klein, who covers Steak and Shake for the QSR Food Trade magazine.
So you're either playing on one side of convenience, or you're, you know, going kind of higher end with some of these upscale fast casuals or sit-down chains or fine dining, you know, people that are taking share like that. So Steak and Shake's case, they're sort of now at a point where they're not really, you know, they're not really offering either of those.
Owner Sardar Biglari is a mysterious figure who does not do media interviews. He didn't respond to a request for comment from GLT. His only public comments typically come in his annual shareholder letters. In his 2019 letter, Biglari conceded that they, quote, erroneously stayed with equipment and kitchen design that was ill-suited for volume production, and that the effect was high-cost, labor-intensive, slow service. He says they failed customers by not being fast and friendly. They paid the price for that. Steak and Shake's revenue last year declined 3.5%, what Biglari himself called a significant disappointment. During the first quarter of 2019, same-store sales fell almost 8%, the 10th straight quarterly decline, even as other similar restaurants saw growth. David Henkes is with Technomic, a research and consulting firm for the restaurant industry.
I mean, they're playing smack dab in a very competitive set, from big national players, right, you know, that have huge reach and big marketing dollars, and, you know, all the way down to small local or, you know, regional chains or even, you know, independent burger places.
Henkes says Steak and Shake isn't doing much to differentiate itself.
Not that it's, you know, the death knell for the chain, but it's certainly a challenge for them to grow out of that without doing something different.
And something different is an ambitious strategy that Biglari laid out earlier this year. He wants to franchise off all 400 company-owned restaurants. Franchisees will only have to put up about $10,000. It's a bargain in the industry, and they'll pay 15% of sales and 50% of profits back to Steak and Shake. And franchisees can only own one restaurant. That's similar to the Chick-fil-A model, geared toward hands-on franchise ownership. Experts tell GLT that retroactively turning a restaurant chain into an all-franchise model is a bit unusual, and to prepare for it, Steak and Shake has temporarily closed dozens of stores that will theoretically be franchised, including some in Peoria. But when a restaurant temporarily closes, restaurant journalist Danny Klein says they tend not to reopen.
I haven't seen anybody offer up a franchise for $10,000 in the time that I've been here. And the whole thing, and everything they're doing right now is pretty uncommon. So I guess we don't really know how it's going to turn out.
Steak and Shake also faces a big challenge in court. Nearly 1,500 Steak and Shake managers across the country have sued the company, claiming they were improperly classified as salary employees and not compensated for the overtime they worked. Around 280 managers from the St. Louis area were just awarded $7.5 million in the first of two lawsuits. The second pending lawsuit has just under 1,200 plaintiffs, including around 400 from Illinois. That's according to their attorney, Brendan Donnellan of Kansas City, Missouri. Donnellan says these managers were making only $32,000 to $40,000 a year and were doing much of the same work as lower-level hourly employees.
So their job was to just plug in the holes each and every shift. And I think it's pretty easy to figure out that if you're not having to pay the hourly people overtime to do all this work or to have extra hourly people there, and you're paying one person just a set dollar amount to work 70 hours a week, it's a big cost-cutting and savings measure for a company.
Steak and Shake said each case is without merit and it intends to defend these cases vigorously. However, Donnellan says the company is set for settlement talks with plaintiffs from both cases in early June. So does this all add up to the end for Steak and Shake? Greg Andrews, who covers the company from Indianapolis, says Steak and Shake has about $184 million in debt that it's supposed to pay off in March of 2021.
It's losing a lot of money at the moment, so it really doesn't have the ability to pay that off. If it starts to turn itself around, then lenders would probably give it a lot more breathing room. But if it's in a tailspin, which is what it really is in today, that debt could force Steak and Shake into bankruptcy.
A significant retraction, fewer locations, may be more likely. Danny Klein says it's not uncommon today to see restaurant chains retract pretty dramatically. Applebee's is one recent example.
I think a chain of this type of scale and, you know, guest affinity and history and the fact that they were on a really good run there for, you know, a pretty good period of time, I would be surprised to see them go bankrupt. But I would also say that it's definitely nothing is ever impossible in this industry. I mean, restaurants are such a fluctuating kind of business.
Brendan Donlan, the attorney who represents the managers, says it's hard to speculate about the company's financial health because Steak and Shake is just one part of the Biglari Holdings portfolio. Biglari also owns Maxim Magazine and the Western Sizzlin' restaurant chain, among other investments.
It's hard for me to look at that and decipher exactly which of that are Steak and Shake assets and Steak and Shake liabilities, things along those lines. So it's always a concern in all of my cases, but it's hard for me to speculate here whether or not it's going to have a big impact on our verdict and on our second lawsuit.
Greg Snodgrass, the busboy who became a district manager, gave the company another chance himself. He returned from 2010 to 2013, but it wasn't enjoyable anymore. He says the family-friendly atmosphere was gone. He left again.
Just keeps piling on. Some talk that it may even just fold up and go away, which I hope doesn't happen.
Sardar Biglari says it will take 3 years for the refranchising plan to be completed.
That was Ryan Denham with that report. And read more about the problems with the restaurant chain Steak and Shake. There's a link at our website, statewideshow.com. If you've been outside this spring, you've probably noticed more flying insects like gnats and mosquitoes. In some areas, people are having to fight off swarms. Nick Sider is a research assistant professor of field crop entomology at the U of I's Department of Crop Sciences, and I had a chance to talk with him. And Nick, I assume that some of the reason we're seeing so many of these bugs right now is because of the wet spring?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there's a variety of different insects, especially different types of flies. Of course, mosquitoes are a type of fly. That's the one that we're most worried about. That's the one where when we have a lot of standing and especially stagnant water out there from some of these heavy rains and from some of these flooding events, that's lots of great breeding sites for mosquitoes. There's also a variety of other insects that aren't necessarily biting insects. Some midges and different other types of small flies that can do the same thing. They'll breed and develop in that standing water. They won't necessarily bite people, but they can be more of a nuisance. But the primary one we're going to be worried about is mosquitoes in the standing water. And then in areas where there's more running water, more flowing water, like when the rivers are high and that kind of thing, you can see an increase in buffalo gnats, which are a different type of biting fly.
I feel like I've seen a lot of the buffalo gnats here in central Illinois. A few years back, we seemed to also have quite a few of those. And then after a couple of weeks, that subsided. Do you expect the same thing to happen here, or does it depend on the weather?
It does depend on the weather, but it is seasonal also. So they do tend to subside once the real heat of the summer comes on. Big issue with buffalo gnats is that regular insect repellents aren't quite as effective against them. They're also quite painful. But then, of course, for mosquitoes, the best thing you can do for yourself is to get a good insect repellent. Use that when you go outside just to avoid being bitten. The other thing you can do for mosquitoes is to remove sources of standing water, especially in your home. Tire swings are one that gets talked about a lot, you know, but bird baths are another one. A lot of times those sources of standing water that are out there just need to be refreshed. Just every once in a while you have to pour that water out. If it's something like a bird bath where you want water in it, just refresh that water so that insects aren't developing, and particularly mosquitoes aren't developing in it.
Well, you said insect repellent. If you go to the store, there's all sorts of claims made by different ones. Is there something that people should look for ingredient-wise, at least, that is the best for folks to use?
With mosquitoes, there are several that are effective. The one that I've had the most luck with are repellents that contain DEET, D-E-E-T. For buffalo gnats, I don't know that I'm as equipped to evaluate them. I know there's some effective products on the market for that insect.
When I hear people talk about a lot of mosquitoes and concerns over that, of course, part of that is not just the nuisance of having them around and being bitten by them, but also the concerns about disease. Is that something that you're watching this time of the year with, you know, with that many around? Are we concerned we're going to see a big year for these types of diseases that are carried by mosquitoes?
That's always a risk, and we're blessed in the Midwest that we don't have a tremendous number of mosquito-borne illnesses in humans. We do have several types of encephalitis, including West Nile virus is probably the most well-known of those, and I don't know if it's the most common or that, but certainly it's the most well-known. So certainly a good reason to protect yourself from mosquitoes. Also important to not forget about your pets. Heartworms, for instance, are spread by mosquito bites in dogs, so it's a good idea to take your animals to the vet, make sure their medications are up to date so that you're protecting them as well.
Can gnats also carry disease, and can they be a health problem as well?
In terms of spreading disease in Illinois, it's really mosquitoes and then ticks, which aren't an insect but are, you know, an arthropod, and can spread Lyme disease and some other things. That's another one you want to protect yourself against anytime you're out in tall grass, but that's not one that's going to be necessarily favored by all this water. But mosquitoes are the primary threat when we're talking about flies and when we're talking about insects that are favored by a lot of water like what we have in the state right now.
Nick Sider is a research assistant professor at the U of I's Department of Crop Sciences. Some good advice: protect yourself and your animals if you're spending time outside. Sider says mosquitoes might be more prevalent in central and southern Illinois right now, but soon there will be plenty in northern Illinois as well. We'll have more of Statewide coming up. We'll look at what state lawmakers did and didn't do in their spring legislative session. That's on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll find out about a major expansion of gambling in Illinois, and we'll break down what the legislation will do. Later, the final classes for an Illinois high school. We'll take a visit there. It's all coming up. After years of struggling to enact a historic overhaul of the state's school funding structure, Illinois lawmakers this session focused on other major initiatives like abortion, cannabis, casinos, and a new income tax system. But public schools are facing another growing problem that lawmakers have not quite figured out how to fix. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
In radio, we try not to spout a lot of numbers because those tend to go in one ear and out the other. So let's just say when the General Assembly adjourned a few days ago, public schools were set to receive $8.8 billion, virtually every penny they requested. But there are some problems money alone can't solve.
The biggest discussion over the Capitol for K-12 education really focused around the teacher shortage.
That's Amanda Elliott, Director of Legislative Affairs for the State Board of Education.
This is something that has been discussed for the last several years.
And yet the shortage, already severe, is getting worse. According to a recent survey, more than 85% of school superintendents say they have trouble hiring teachers.
Last year, the legislature passed a law that allowed for reciprocity.
So now anyone who holds a teacher license in another state automatically qualifies for a credential here. That change brought Illinois a 20% bump in applications.
This year, the conversation really focused around testing. We had two bills passed that eliminate the basic skills test.
That's a test introduced in the 1980s. It's been revamped three times, making it increasingly difficult. 75% of potential teachers flunk the test, which means they aren't even allowed to take teacher prep courses. Lawmakers also considered eliminating the two other big tests required for a teaching license.
There were different iterations of bills that were filed that eliminated content tests and the teacher performance assessment altogether. But eventually we landed on just eliminating the basic skills test and studying content tests.
Kyle Thompson is Assistant Regional Superintendent of a 7-county area in East Central Illinois, and he has so many teacher vacancies, he traveled to Springfield to testify against what he regards as excessive teacher testing twice. He says killing that basic skills test just isn't enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, for all the effort that was put in throughout this spring session, I just don't feel like we came out with enough solutions or as great of an impact as we could have and should have.
Thompson blames colleges that run teacher preparation programs. Their officials showed up en masse to testify against the bill Thompson supported, which would have eliminated all three tests.
I'll never forget sitting in that room, and then 10 or 12 different university professors or deans or whatever went up and stood around that table first. You were in the room. And that was the group that, you know, was advocating essentially for status quo.
Elliott, whose job is essentially to act as the ambassador in charge of negotiations between lawmakers and the state board, admits more changes are needed.
Eliminating the basic skills test, I think, will help, but it is only one small component. We really need to have additional conversations about other barriers to the teaching field. I think another bill that passed that will help the teacher shortage is the minimum teacher salary bill. Making sure that teachers are paid what they deserve, I think, is important and will hopefully help encourage more people to come to the field. Other things that need to be looked at include pensions, working conditions, respect for the profession. And those are all really, you know, big rocks that will take time to evaluate and address.
In her calm, diplomatic tone, she points out that one new measure requires the state board to review content area tests to see whether some need to be updated or scrapped. Thompson, whose job includes helping find teachers for schools in 25 rural districts, sounds more like that student who legitimately needs a fidget spinner.
I feel like we're always creating task force and forming committees. I feel like it just takes so long. And every year we do this, it's just another year of our lives and our efforts just not filling positions in rural areas, you know? And so, like, I get it. I'm sure they'll do the task force. I'm sure they'll come up with some solutions, I hope. I guess I'm just baffled. I just don't think all the people that were in such opposition to all these changes, I don't think they realize how bad it is.
You can read about other education plans considered by lawmakers this session. You can check out Dusty's full report. It's available. There's a link at our website, statewideshow.com. State lawmakers also passed a major gambling expansion in Illinois, and Daisy Contreras followed that action. She joins me now to fill us all in on what took place. One of the big parts of this gambling expansion, Daisy, had to do with sports wagering. You'll be able to do that in Illinois soon. What do we know about that right now?
So horse racing tracks, casinos, and certain sporting venues will get the opportunity to purchase a license to offer sports wagering. These will be for the brick-and-mortar licenses. And if those casinos or racetracks partner up with a vendor for online betting, then both the in-person and mobile betting can take place as soon as the Illinois Gaming Board accepts the applications and vets them. Now, what if you don't have a casino and if you wanted to offer only online betting? Well, you'd have to wait several months before you can apply for one of the three available online licenses. And from what I'm told, this will be a very competitive selection process because the Gaming Board has to make sure the opportunity is given to businesses owned by minorities, women, veterans, and people with disabilities. But there are the big companies like FanDuel and DraftKings who might want to get in on the action too. So more because if they partner up with a casino right now, for example, to offer online wagering, they have to operate under the casino brand name. So they want to get their name out there. So they're going to have to wait for that.
Well, we've seen gambling expand in Illinois going back to the state lottery. And then, of course, later came riverboat gambling. And it's moved on to having gambling right in your own neighborhood with some of these video machines that are in bars and restaurants. But this was a big step, sports betting.
Yeah, it really was. Because a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed it to be regulated outside of Nevada. So states jumped in on the opportunity, and several states have already done that. I mean, and also good to mention, gambling on college sports will not be allowed under this bill, and professional sports leagues will not get a cut of the money.
Now, I haven't heard a time frame for sports betting to actually take off in Illinois to where you could actually go and make your bet, but we think it's going to be pretty soon, right?
Yes, as soon as the governor signs the legislation, the Illinois Gaming Board will probably start accepting applications. They will go through a vetting process, and once that happens, if the casinos have the capacity to start offering it, then it should be off the ground pretty soon.
So maybe by football season even.
That's
possibly
what I'm told, yeah.
So along with that, 6 new casinos. And when we say new casinos, is that what we're actually talking about here, that these are going to be these big operations like we've seen in other towns?
I know for sure that the one in Chicago would. That is one of the most notable places, Rockford in southern Illinois, in what's known as Walker's Bluff, one in the south Chicago suburbs, Danville and Waukegan. Now, to see the extent of how big they will be, we don't know. I mean, they have the option not to build a casino, but Rockford and Carterville labor groups lobbied hard in Springfield this session, and as they have in many other sessions, just to make sure that they could get on this list. They argued that the opportunity would help them create jobs, not just during the construction of their projects, but also once the casinos are established, they'll be able to have people employed from the community.
A lot of people might be surprised to know that Springfield does not have a casino. You always think of it as a pretty politically connected town, but it's also included in here with a little special addendum for the city of Springfield for the state fairgrounds.
Yeah, slot machines will be allowed at the state fairgrounds. The mayor here lobbied for a casino, but Springfield did not make the list.
Horse tracks. They have for years complained about loss of customers and people coming in there to bet on the horses because of casinos. They feel as though they've been in competition and they've not been winning that competition through the years. Was there something in here for horse tracks as well?
Yes. I mean, not only will they get the opportunity to offer sports gambling, which all the different gaming industries really wanted as a new industry to help them attract more gamblers, but the horse tracks will also get the permission to have slots and table games on their premises, basically casino-style games. And these will get up to 1,200 positions from the ones that they don't have right now.
And they think that will be enough to help boost that industry, which it does create jobs. There's no doubt there are people that raise the horses, feed for the horses, all of that. But they think this will be enough?
Yeah, they were here in Springfield, a lot of them saying exactly that this will help create jobs and attract more people.
Does anything in this change video gambling like we see at, again, as bars, restaurants, places like that, we see a lot of it and has become quite popular in many communities? Anything change because of this legislation?
Yes, under the plan, video gambling machines will be okay for larger truck stops. The maximum bet was also increased. Maybe something that wasn't supported by the video gaming industry is that the taxes increased from the current 30% to 33% in the first year and 34% in the second year and moving forward. So what the industry was saying that this was going to hurt these video gaming operators, especially the smaller ones.
And Daisy, you've covered this quite a bit through this session and watched the ups and downs of this legislation all the way till it got passed. But when it comes to gambling legislation in the past, we also call it quite often Christmas tree bills because people start jumping on. And we saw it this time as well. A lot of things get thrown in. It often collapses under that weight. It's almost too big. Well, it didn't collapse this time. Do we know why that was the case?
The gaming expansion bill is attached to a $45 billion capital plan for construction projects. And I think that was one of the main things here that got many lawmakers to vote in favor. So all of the revenue from this expansion will go toward that fund to specifically help with the vertical construction projects, so maintaining any state-owned buildings like prisons and universities. And anything from licensing fees to the tax increases on video gaming, for example, will go to that. I think that in the beginning, like you said, some lawmakers and many stakeholders wanted to keep the sports gambling plan out of the bigger expansion plan out of fears that it would all collapse. But I also think many lawmakers, both Republican and Democrat, understood the need for this capital bill, something that we haven't had for many years. And if the entire package was going to offer some help with that, and if some of it would also help with job creation, many were willing to vote in favor. And I think it took a lot of negotiation at the end.
So this big package gets through. The governor's indicated he's on board with it. Where does that put Illinois when it comes to other states? I've heard somebody use the phrase, the Vegas of the Midwest.
I've heard the same thing, too, over the last several days. neighbors like Iowa and Indiana already legalized sports betting in the last few weeks. Iowa has 19 casinos, while Indiana has 13. Ohio has 11. We would have 16. Under this expansion, Illinois also has also increased the gaming positions. So I think while we have a long way to go to catch up to Nevada, I think a lot is happening at once under this expansion bill, and maybe that's why it seems like there's just so much going on with gambling.
And we'll continue to watch it as it rolls out, and sports betting as well rolling out here in Illinois soon. That's Daisy Contreras. Thanks a lot, Daisy, for following this for us and taking a few minutes here on Statewide.
Thanks for having me.
If you've just tuned in to the middle of Statewide, you can find the complete episode, this one and all our past episodes, at statewideshow.com. And you can also sign up for our weekly podcast through NPR One. The General Assembly finished what, by most accounts, was an historic session. From the legalization of marijuana to the massive expansion of gambling, lawmakers made significant changes to the state, and we thought we'd listen back to some of the voices that made news in the final week of the 2019 legislative session.
It's been a long year. We've had a lot of emotions that have gone on in this chamber.
This is an opportunity to fix the problems of Illinois and begin reestablishing the essential services that government is supposed to deliver.
Here we are debating a constitutional amendment to hike taxes when Wallet Hub says Illinois' tax burden is the highest in the nation.
These definitions seem overly broad, and I am certain that most doctors, if their incentive is to perform an abortion, would be able to find some kind of loophole here to figure that out.
I am disgusted by the propaganda that is out there suggesting that any woman late in her pregnancy, or even after giving birth, as I've heard from some, and then decide, I just don't want this child, and simply end its life.
If we are going to do this, we must ensure that Black and brown communities that have been divested in, that have been locked up and have been castigated to the side, have to be central to this policy, and that is what we have in this bill.
We can disagree, Mr. President, on tax policy and environmental policy, but we can all get on the same page, I hope, that what we don't want to do at this time and place is to do something that will make it more likely that more of our citizenry will at some point develop mental illness.
It's amazing what we can do around here in just a few hours if people are willing to work together. And we just started doing that. So I feel we're on a good path, and I'm pleased to put my vote on the board tonight, and let's get our work done by tomorrow.
We know that as we continue to work collaboratively, that is what we indeed want to do. When we work collaboratively, there are a lot of things that we can indeed get done.
And so we have a situation where many of our buildings, our state buildings, are in a state of poor repair that needs to be remedied.
Now, I know it's difficult to pay for that infrastructure, but anybody who's traveled our roads knows that we've been shortchanging that investment for years. Tonight, we have a very difficult vote, but a necessary vote, because if our infrastructure crumbles, our rural economy crumbles with it.
It's backed by business, it's backed by labor, and it's backed by contractors as well as transit officials.
We're authorizing six casinos: Chicago, Waukegan, South Suburbs, Williamson County, or Walker's Bluff is known, Rockford, and Danville.
I've only been doing this for 20 years trying to get this done, and it's a little emotional. And I have to say, this has been a job creation bill from day one. If we were bringing in six new manufacturers to town, everybody would be on board. Well, guess what? We're putting six types of manufacturing on board. They're going to generate money for the state. They're going to generate employees. They're going to generate economic development, not only in those communities, but in the state of Illinois.
So, Mr. Governor, do you see what a difference it makes to have somebody new in the governor's office? This has been an extraordinarily productive session of the General Assembly. Simply historic.
Illinois is back. Illinois is open for business. This is a place that stands up for working families. I mean, our best days are ahead of us.
Governor J.B. Pritzker, among the voices that made news as the General Assembly wrapped up its legislative session. Up next on Statewide, a group of students learn about death in a cadaver lab. That story and more still on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, some students get a first-hand lesson in death, visiting a cadaver lab. And deactivating a high school will visit one community that has made that decision. That and more still ahead on Statewide. A report published this week shows the 2020 census could neglect to count as many as 4 million people nationwide. Meanwhile, Illinois is putting tens of millions of dollars into making sure no one is missed come next April. Mary Hansen has details.
The report from the Urban Institute shows that Black and Latino populations are at the highest risk of being undercounted. Over the weekend, state lawmakers included $29 million in the upcoming budget with an aim to make sure every resident is included. That amount is a few million short of what some advocacy groups say is needed, but Jay Young says he's optimistic. He's executive director with Common Cause Illinois, a government reform group in Chicago.
We have perhaps the most to lose in the country, so I'm really glad that our legislative leaders, folks in the governor's office and the lieutenant governor's office, were able to help marshal us in the direction of this investment.
The money will be available to community groups and city and county governments. Their charge is to educate the public on how the census works and how the government will use the information it collects. I'm Mary Hansen.
More National Guard troops have been brought in to battle floodwaters along the Illinois and Mississippi rivers. 200 additional soldiers were activated as the rivers continue to rise. This spring, we've seen a major flood event with crests nearing all-time levels. The Guard and other volunteers are trying to shore up levees and keep emergency evacuation routes open. Alicia Tate-Nadeau is the acting director of the state's Emergency Management Agency. When asked to compare this latest round of flooding to the devastation in 1993, she points to the continuous rain, which has raised river levels, and the snowmelt up north that has kept levees saturated for months.
The crests that we're talking about now are not going to just crest and then immediately go down. They are going to continue to stay there because we have both the Mississippi and the Illinois that are converging and full of water.
This problem is statewide. Tate-Nadeau says if there's a river in Illinois, it's likely flooded. Schools are now out for the summer, but we'll hear one last educational experience that Central Illinois high school students had before going off the clock. It involves doctors and dead bodies. Brianna Groh with member station WGLT reports on a unique high school curriculum, the Cadaver Lab, in the small town of Leroy, population about 3,600 in McLean County.
On any given Saturday morning, the average teen might be getting ready for work, heading to practice or a game, or maybe even sleeping in. But at 8 a.m. on this particular day, a group of around 30 high school students are the only teens in the entire country spending the weekend with cadavers. They've willingly given up 4 hours every Saturday morning over the last several months to study gross anatomy at the law office of Dr. Tom Plura in Leroy. With scrubs, lab coats, glasses, and clipboards, the high schoolers look like the real medical professionals many of them want to someday become. Working in small groups, the students buzz around each of the three cadavers laid out on exam tables inside the lab. Today's lab is dubbed the Gland Finale. The students are tasked with identifying all 12 glands of the human body. After about 30 minutes, anatomist Dr. Martha Sweeney and Proctor Jim Zalesnik circle the room to check the students' work. Dr. Sweeney stops to help a group of students at one of the two male cadavers. They can't seem to find the final two glands.
It's just the liver.
The liver is the gland? Oh, okay. So it's the kidney gland? So it's the kidney gland too?
Yes.
At the female cadaver, Zalesnik helps the students identify another gland they've missed. He gestures inside the body's chest, just below the neck.
Right down in here, started with a T. Remember we talked about it with all... All we can see in the rest of the cadavers, because they're old, is just a little piece of fat anymore left. Thymus gland. And remember, the thymus gland.
Zalesnik explains the thymus gland, part of the body's immune system, disappears as we age. The students are just 17 and 18 years old, and yet they're dealing with subject matter most adults shy away from. But Lisa Tomlin, who teaches advanced placement biology at Normal Community West High School and serves as a proctor for the lab, says the students take a different approach to the experience.
For these young people, the capacity that they have for learning really has made this maybe be an easy transition for them, that in death, these people are still teaching. And so they're looking at it, I think, maybe a little differently. It's not as the end, but really another phase of what the body can do for the future. And so they seem to be able to handle it, honestly, better than most adults that we have come through the doors.
Normal Community High School senior Jake Simonson says while his first day in the lab was a lot to take in, he got used to it pretty quickly.
I really like just getting to learn like a bunch of stuff that I had no idea even existed in our body. Like, it's really cool to see like on the cadaver and then think about how that is, that part of the body is working like in your own body to keep you alive. And that's just like really interesting to think about, that we're all like have the same anatomy going on, and like we are able to see it like firsthand on a real human body.
That excitement about studying medicine is the reason Dr. Tom Plura founded the lab nearly 6 years ago. He hopes the program will inspire students to join the medical practice in some fashion. Dr. Plura says his undergraduate gross anatomy class was the formative experience of his time in school.
Far and away, that was the best class that I ever had, and I want to open that up. There's no reason why you can't offer a similar program to area high school students.
And for the students who do decide to pursue a career in medicine, Dr. Plura says the program gives them a real leg up.
This isn't just somebody watching a doctor or a college professor dissect. The high school students are actually in there dissecting from day one. So there isn't any better way to learn, in my opinion, for a student other than to just jump in and do it.
Mitch Augustine, a senior at Normal Community West High School, says there's another advantage to being in the program.
Actually, this is the only high school experience you can put on your medical school application, so that's like amazing. And then like if we were to actually go through the physiology and anatomy during class, we would know more than most students in the class, which would be pretty cool.
Leroy School District Superintendent Gary Tipsard says the students aren't the only ones gaining valuable experience in the lab.
You have teachers in our high schools who are teaching anatomy to students who, when they proctor in that lab, they get some of the best professional development that is available anywhere. And so now they can translate that over to 40, 50, 60 kids that they're teaching in their classrooms. So there are so many layers to the impact of trying to do things like this that have a much more significant benefit than what you just see inside the lab.
Tipsard says to his knowledge, the lab in Leroy is still the only program in the nation that allows high school students to dissect cadavers. He credits the lab's singularity to the innovative partnership between Dr. Plura and the school district. Dr. Plura works with the McLean County Medical Society to buy the bodies. Tipsard and the school district build the curriculum, recruit area students, and secure proctors for the lab. The district also contributes money from a special programming fund to support the lab.
And so when you bring those two types of things together, so business and industry that's willing to do something non-traditional and an educational system willing to do something non-traditional, all to the benefit of young people, that is what made it possible. And that's not everybody embraces that idea.
Tipsard says he continues to hear from educators looking to start their own lab.
Tremont has hosted one in the Peoria area, and we continue to talk to people in the Champaign area about the potential of hosting one in the Champaign area, and we'll see where those things go. But our hope would be that we simply open the door of opportunity for other schools so that we're no longer the only one. That's our hope.
After their final lab, the students turn in letters they've written to the families of the deceased. Mitch and her classmate Michael McKee explain the letters are meant to show their appreciation to the families for supporting their loved one's decision to donate their body.
So it was basically just thank you for helping us with this opportunity to learn about the human body.
Yeah, we couldn't get detailed or too personal because this is someone's loved one, they're actual people, but at the same time show our appreciation for the opportunity.
And we also told them what we were going into to show this was not a waste and this we actually used what they gave us.
Dr. Plura says he hears similar feedback from students that show they understand just how unique an opportunity they've been given.
I haven't had not one single student say, no, I'm unhappy that I took the class. Not one. They all just are enamored by it. So I'm confident we're doing the right thing.
The students are confident as well. Several have gone on to medical school to become nurses, veterinarians, and yes, doctors. I'm Brianna Grow.
A small rural town in northern Illinois voted to deactivate its high school in the fall. So what's it like to be the last graduating class there, and how has the community reacted? Peter Medlin visited the school just before the end of classes.
The final seconds tick off the clock and the school day is over. One of the last of the school year at Pawpaw. Buses are lined up outside waiting for students as they trickle out. The halls are a little more empty now. The senior class has already graduated. It's a small taste of what the school will look like next year, when there are no high schoolers left at all. Pawpaw voters decided to deactivate their high school last November. They'll still have kindergarten through 8th grade, but the high schoolers will now be bused to nearby Indian Creek High School. Pawpaw has been facing the same funding and enrollment struggles plaguing rural schools across the state. Their total K-12 enrollment dropped by more than 30 students in the last 5 years. Their district currently sits just under 200 students. In the meantime, Indian Creek will be adding more than 50 students with the new Pawpaw kids. The deactivation vote narrowly passed, and only one Pawpaw high schooler was old enough to vote in the election.
And I voted to actually keep the school here.
His name is Anthony Castaldo. He's a member of that final graduating class.
It is weird. You have these bunch of other people who get to, the alumni of their schools get to go back to their school, visit it. And I don't really get to do that, but that's okay.
Even though he knew there were supporters of the deactivation, he was still surprised to see it passed.
I remember there was a bunch of Facebook arguments about that, but I thought that was just an overreaction from a small group of people. I didn't realize how many people were willing to just deactivate the school.
Students at the schools are already very familiar with each other. They had homecoming together this year, and Pawpaw students had already been going to Indian Creek for some sports and classes. Kendall Habaker is a 16-year-old finishing her sophomore year at Pawpaw.
Yeah, I take Spanish 1 and World Geography over there.
One of the perks of the new students coming over is that Indian Creek will expand class offerings. That includes an upper-level Spanish 4 course.
I've lived in Pawpaw my whole entire life, and my dad and his brother and my grandma also graduated from Pawpaw.
Her family eventually supported the deactivation, but the decision wasn't easy.
They were kind of surprised and sad, too, because, Pawpaw has been here forever, and, we're the only, small town that, has really lasted for so long.
Along with the students, only one Pawpaw High School teacher will be moving over to Indian Creek. Pawpaw Superintendent Stan Adcock says he hopes the district can keep on those other teachers in any way they can. Castaldo said some of his teachers were upset by the vote.
I know a bunch of my teachers didn't expect it. So a bunch of my teachers I know just took it harshly, especially the ones who've been here for quite a while.
The end of the school year has been especially bittersweet for Patty Torman. She's been an administrator at Pawpaw for 27 years, and she's retiring. The news is still reaching some of the students.
Yes, I'm going to retire.
No!
I remember when you started! Well, it was nice meeting you. For
nice
that
meeting
month
you.
I've been here.
Yeah. I'll see ya.
Yeah.
She said she'll still be around. She lives close and has a granddaughter in elementary school at Pawpaw. The school is still figuring out what exactly to do with the empty space without the high school. But despite the deactivation, Pawpaw will continue to offer kindergarten through 8th grade classes. I'm Peter Medlin.
That wraps up another episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and tune in again at this time next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can get a podcast of our show at NPR One and find all of our episodes at our website, statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.